well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. I'm looking forward to this for a while now. Jacob Sullum from Reason Magazine has got a new book, Beyond Control: Drug Prohibition, Gun Regulation, and the Search for Sensible Alternatives. Now, you can see by my bookmark here, I'm about halfway through reading the book in its entirety, but I have perused all of the chapters, so I feel like I've got a pretty good grasp on what Jacob has to say and what he has written. In fact, I talked a little bit about this in the intro to yesterday's program, recommending the book for you. I've read a couple more chapters since then. And I stand by my recommendation. I think this is a great book. It is full of fascinating and disturbing history, as well as, again, some suggestions about, how we can reduce violent crime, how we can improve public safety without infringing on our right to keep and bear arms, which is where we're primarily going to focus. Jacob also has some recommendations on, dealing with drug addiction without engaging or contributing or continuing the war on drugs. But I'll probably leave that mostly for another interview. Although, I mean, the issue of guns and drugs has intersected quite a bit in the courts as of late, including the 10th Circuit just yesterday releasing an opinion in a case called U.S. versus Harrison. Mostly agreed with a district court that tossed out the charges of possessing a firearm while an unlawful user of drugs, ruling that to be unconstitutional. But actually remain in this case back down to district court with the recommendation or the order that the government prove that non-intoxicated marijuana users pose a threat of danger, that they are dangerous enough to disarm even when they are not actively using cannabis. There is a circuit court split, at least a four-way split at this point, on Section 922 G3 and its constitutionality. Supreme Court has about a half dozen cases, I think five cases, dealing with that issue in one aspect or another that are awaiting consideration this fall. So this is a timely book by Jacob Sullum because, again, this issue, particularly when it comes to medical marijuana users, recreational marijuana users, and whether or not they can exercise their Second Amendment rights, that is something that the Supreme Court will hopefully be dealing with in the very near future. It's one of the things we talked about with Jacob. Take a look and a listen. Jacob, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to talk to you, sir.
Likewise.
And I got to say, this is a fantastic read. I talked about this a little bit on the program yesterday, encouraging folks to pick up a copy of Beyond Control. You can see by my bookmark, I'm about halfway through reading the book in its entirety, but I did skip ahead last night so I could read the final chapter. So I got to go back and fill in the gaps. But, obviously you've been covering Second Amendment issues. You've been covering the war on drugs, as you write, for, 30 some odd years here. This is something that I guess you and I are both kind of old hats when it comes at least to Second Amendment issues. I want to ask you first off, because, you get into in the last part of your book recommendations, things that we can do differently. Do you think that there has been any progress in that regard in getting rid of the old paradigms of the war on drugs and the war on guns? Has there been any progress, you think, since you've been covering these issues?
Well, there's been, sometimes one step forward and a couple steps back, but I see progress in a few areas. When it comes to drug policy, the concept of harm reduction, which I emphasize in the book, has gained some currency. And the idea there is that the focus of drug policy be on reducing harm. And that includes the harm that caused by misguided government policies. So when you ask about the risks that the average drug user faces, those are very clearly compounded by the war on drugs. First of all, when you buy something on the black market, you don't really know what you're getting. And that has proven to be really damaging in the case of opioid-related deaths, where you have people, initially they were buying what they thought was heroin, turned out to either be have fentanyl in it or to be entirely replaced with fentanyl. And initially, there was no experience with this. And you see the results in the steady increase in drug related deaths. That problem was compounded further by the crackdown on pain medication, because the government said doctors are overprescribing. We need to stop this.
Mm-hmm.
So even to the extent that you're reaching the non-medical users, which is the ostensible aim, it also, you know, caused a lot of harm to actual bona fide pain patients who then had trouble getting adequate treatment for their pain. But to the extent that you're actually reducing the supply to non-medical users, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to go to the black market, and the products they buy on the black market are much more dangerous because the potency is unpredictable. You don't know exactly what's in it. And you see the results of that. After the crackdown on pain medication prescriptions, you saw not only a continued increase in opioid-related deaths, but an acceleration of that trend. So those are ways in which policy makes the situation worse. And so there are various approaches to that include things like fentanyl test strips, so you can tell whether fentanyl is present in the drug that you're buying. It includes things, more controversial things like supervised consumption facilities, which have begun in some cities across the country. And that was sort of tentatively embraced by the Biden administration. The idea there is that you can go to a safe setting, still bringing your own drugs. So it doesn't solve the problem of the unreliable drug supply, but you're doing it under supervision, which means if you get into trouble, that people can help you. And that's crucial. So, and also you're doing it in a safer setting. You're not doing it in a park. You're not doing it in a McDonald's bathroom or whatever. The result is that in those facilities, you have no fatalities because there are people there to help if people get into trouble. And so that's one approach that has gained some currency in various places across the United States that reflects this sort of harm reduction approach where you're saying, if we're focused on reducing the number of drug-related deaths, what does it make sense to do?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, but this gets, I think, to, you know, the inherent tension that I think is at the heart of your book here, right, is that those policies are way more popular among Democrats than Republicans. Yet, you know, you could look at an argument that says, you know, listen, in a city like Chicago or Washington, D.C., where there are no ranges available, but there's a lot of violent crime, what would happen if we actually encouraged a culture of responsible gun ownership? Well, that'd probably be far more popular among Republicans than Democrats, right? And that's sort of, again, what you get to in this book is that, you know, generally speaking, Democrats aren't as supportive of the war on drugs, but they're all in on the war on guns. And the opposite is generally true when we're talking about Republicans, right? Far less supportive of attacks on gun ownership, far more supportive of getting tough on drugs, which includes drug users, not just drug dealers and drug traffickers. Is it your hope that folks reading this book, what is your hope for Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals who are reading your book? What do you hope they come away with?
Well, my argument is that the concerns raised by people on the left who tend to be critical of the war on drugs and people on the right who tend to be critical of gun control are essentially the same. They make many of the same points. And this goes back to the early history of these laws. In both cases, you see the impact of racism, certainly in the case of gun control. But look at the early history of gun control. This is all about preventing slave insurrections, keeping the black man in his place, explicitly so, right? It wasn't, you didn't have to do any kind of interpretation. Those policies after the 14th Amendment, you know, they weren't supposed to be explicitly aimed at black people anymore, but in practice they were. And then even today, you see a continuing disproportionate impact on black people as a result of gun control. And this is something conservatives have emphasized in challenging gun control laws, that, you know, who is most severely harmed by these restrictions? Well, black people disproportionately live in high crime areas, and those same places tend to have the strictest gun control laws. And if you look at the major, you know, Supreme Court cases, you know, the first one, Heller, was, it began as a case brought by a black woman in Washington, D.C., who wanted to have a gun for self-protection.
Yep.
And she ultimately dropped out because she was deemed not to have standing, but I think that's significant. And then in the Chicago case, this was a black man in Chicago, who, again, just wanted to have a gun for self-protection. A handgun was not allowed to. And in the late, and in the New York case, the more recent one, you had briefs that pointed out the disproportionate impact of strict gun control on people of color, who are, were especially likely to be arrested for illegal gun possession, even if they only had the gun for self-protection.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I think absolutely. Conservatives see that when it comes to gun control. But when it comes to the war on drugs, you have a similar history and a similar disproportionate impact. The early drug laws, starting with the ban on opium dens in San Francisco in the 19th century, were very clearly colored by prejudice, in that case against Chinese immigrants, but in other cases with cocaine, you see the early agitation against cocaine very prominently featured this concern about black people using cocaine and becoming uncontrollable, becoming violent, raping white women, that sort of thing. And with the early marijuana laws, you see a similar animus against Mexicans. So you can argue over the extent to which those feelings, you know, gave rise to those laws, but they clearly played a significant role.
Yeah, absolutely.
And progressives emphasize that, and they say,
"I'm not hearing you, sir." You're back. You're back.
Okay, all right. I may be having low battery problems.
Okay.
so if it continues, I'll switch to a different headset. But and progressives point out that. The war on drugs continues to have a disproportionate effect on black people, who are especially likely to be arrested for drug offenses, even though the survey data suggests they're not more likely, or at least not significantly more likely than white people to use drugs. The data on involvement in drug dealing is a little bit iffier, but it does not, any difference, interracial difference in drug dealing does not explain the differences in arrests and prosecutions and prison sentences.
Yeah.
So those are very similar points that are raised by both sides, but they tend not to see the common ground that they share. And then when you ask about, you know, how are these laws implemented in practice? Well, very haphazard, both of them, right? Because you have huge numbers of potential defendants in both cases. Think about marijuana users who own guns. Every marijuana user who owns a gun is committing a federal felony every day. Mm-hmm. Almost none of them are prosecuted, but some are. And people, I just wrote about a guy who's serving 4 years in federal prison because he was a marijuana user who owned guns. That's the sort of situation invites arbitrary enforcement. And it may be racially disproportionate. It certainly is unfair to the few people who actually get caught and punished. And then you know, conservatives and progressives are both concerned about police abuse, you know, overzealous law enforcement, draconian penalties that the few people who are actually prosecuted end up suffering. And they both say this is not working. This is not having its advertised effect. Gun control is not reducing crime. The war on drugs is not reducing substance abuse. And so how does it make sense to continue pursuing these policies that are hurting a lot of innocent, peaceful people, subjecting them to arrest and punishment for no good reason, and at the same time not having the effect that it's supposed to have?
Yeah, absolutely. You went through a lot there. So I don't know where I want to go next. I will say this. I would not call this a history book, but there is a lot of great history in this book. I consider myself to be, you know, pretty well versed on certainly, you know, the racist gun laws and the black tradition of arms. You know, Nicholas Johnson's book, Negroes and the Guns, a couple of years ago that came out, Charles Cobb's This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. I think, you know, I have read both of those books on multiple occasions. And I still learned some new stuff reading this. In fact, there was a you talk about an incident in the 1930s that happened about an hour away from where I live in Gordonsville, Virginia, where a black couple who basically their property was going to be seized to expand a local cemetery ended up fending off a mob of anywhere between 2,000 and 5,000 people for a period of hours. They were firing machine guns into this house. And because they had firearms, they were able to defend themselves, at least until their house was set on fire. And they were sadly killed. I had not heard about that incident. I had no idea that that existed until I read your book. So, again, if folks, you know, even if you think you know these stories, you think you know this history, you're going to learn something new when you read Jacob's book. But, you know, we also are getting back to this case that you just talked about. We are now seeing this intersection. I think this is a great time for your book to come out because the Supreme Court right now has, I believe, 5 cases pending for consideration dealing with Section 922G3, which is the statute that says unlawful users of drugs can't possess firearms. In fact, we just saw the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals with a decision yesterday saying that the government has to be able to show that non-intoxicated marijuana users are dangerous in order to justify the prosecution of a gentleman. I believe he was arrested in Lawton, Oklahoma, in possession of a revolver. And there was also, you know, personal amounts of marijuana in his car. So this is an issue that the courts are wrestling with, too, now. Right. This intersection of guns and drugs. Do you think the Supreme Court is ready to take this case? And do you think that they are ready to acknowledge that, you know, not all drug users, even if they're breaking the law, are dangerous per se, and that maybe the statute, at least as is applied to some Americans, maybe not facially, but as it is applied to some Americans, is in fact unconstitutional?
Potentially, yes. I mean, what you're seeing in the federal courts is that they generally are not receptive to facial challenges, saying right. The statute is completely unconstitutional, because they can imagine some applications where the person really is dangerous, a threat to public safety, and it might be justified. But they are several courts, several appeals courts have been receptive to as applied challenges, meaning this particular person happens to be a marijuana user, but doesn't mean they're dangerous, and they haven't presented any evidence to suggest that they are. Therefore, this is unconstitutional as applied to them. And you just had a case in the 11th Circuit involving medical marijuana users in Florida, mm-hmm. where the court revived a Second Amendment challenge to the ban on gun possession.
Nope, we've lost your audio again there, Jacob.
Can you hear me now?
I can, yes.
Okay. You know, the 11th Circuit said it's not enough simply to say this person's an illegal drug user, therefore they have no Second Amendment rights. And by the way, this is one of the examples that gives me hope, because Ron DeSantis, who is not anybody's idea of a drug policy reformer, backed that lawsuit saying people have a Second Amendment rights. If you're using a legal product, and in Florida, it is legal to use marijuana for medical purposes, that shouldn't deprive you of your Second Amendment rights. So I see hope there for a sort of crossover. That lawsuit was initially brought by a Democrat who was the head of the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, who actually had tried to run against DeSantis for governor. But they saw eye to eye on that particular issue. Right. And mm-hmm. now, of course, we're in transition with marijuana because it's legal. You know, most Americans live in states where it's actually legal for recreational use as well as medical use. So that's a drug that's sort of in transition. So I think it's easier for people to say that makes no sense. The state says I'm allowed to use this, and somehow I have no right to possess firearms under federal law. So I think that's an opportunity to sort of build bridges between people who belong to different parties and maybe have different ideologies. So they can start to see the implications of these policies for people who have done nothing to justify, you know, treating them as criminals.
Yeah. I hope that you're right, because I think, and I absolutely believe that you're correct when you say that there's common ground to be found here. When we kind of break out of that, you know, just the rigid ideological positions that we take, and we actually look at these issues from, you know, applying that Second Amendment for conservatives anyway, applying that Second Amendment standard to, you know, the war on drugs, and for liberals applying that, you know, legalization standard to the right to keep and bear arms. I think that there, like you say, there is just a lot of commonality in the arguments against these things. There's also, again, I think a lot of commonality in ways to, you know, improve public safety, to reduce drug addiction without involving law enforcement, without putting people in prison, right? Whether it is things like violence intervention programs that don't involve law enforcement, even things like, you know, Operation Ceasefire, which I know you talk about in your book, that that does have a law enforcement component, but also offers people a pathway to stay out of prison and to get, you know, job training, GED, counseling, whatever they need to turn their life around. We've even seen, you know, some, that was a program that started in Boston. I don't think anybody would call David Kennedy, who was one of the architects of this, a rock ribbed conservative. But, you know, you've got Virginia Attorney General Jason Meares, who's wholeheartedly behind Operation Ceasefire. He's been able to put that in place in Virginia. So I think there is reason to be optimistic. And again, I think you've got a lot of great suggestions in here, a lot of great history. And I would encourage everybody to pick up Beyond Control. Jacob, thank you so much for your time today. I always enjoy talking to you. It's been way too long, but I hope we get to do this again in the future.
Thanks a lot.
My thanks to Jacob for joining me on the program. And again, I would recommend that you pick up a copy of Beyond Control for yourself. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story. Our good deed of the day and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a disturbing case out of North Carolina reported by the New York Post with the headline, homeless man accused of killing Ukrainian refugee, assaulted his own sister just months after prison release. Now, that prison release happened 5 years ago, so I doubt that even if this individual had been, you know, hit with the most serious punishment possible, that he'd still be behind prison for that incident. But you can argue that 34-year-old DeCarlos Brown Jr. should have been at least in a secure facility based on mental illness. According to the New York Post, he's been charged with fatally stabbing Arina Zarutska, who recently fled Ukraine and ended up in Charlotte, North Carolina. She was fatally stabbed at a train station in Charlotte last Friday. The New York Post reports that Brown is a serial criminal who spent most of his adult life in and out of jail. Rapshi goes back to 2011, includes felony larceny, robbery with a dangerous weapon, and communicating threats, according to court records obtained by the Post. He served 5 years in prison for that armed robbery charge, only to be arrested for assaulting his sister just months after he was released in September of 2020. The most recent arrest before he allegedly killed Zarutska was in January of this year when police conducted a welfare check on him and he asked him to investigate a, quote, man-made material that was inside his body that was controlling his actions. According to the New York Post, officers advised Brown that he was suffering a medical issue and that there was nothing that they could do to help him. That response made him upset, which led him to call 911. He was then arrested for abusing the 911 system, according to the Charlotte Observer. Now, I don't know about you, but to me, somebody who is agitated, upset, says that there is some sort of man-made material, some foreign body inside him that's controlling his actions. I mean, I think it would be appropriate to take that individual into custody for a mental health hold at that point, right? Now, that didn't happen. We don't know what would have happened had he been placed under a 72-hour mental health hold. It could be that the mental health professionals who examined him would have said, he's not a danger to himself or others, and they would have put him back on the streets. But again, given this individual's repeated run-ins with the law, it certainly suggests that maybe mental illness is a component of his actions in the past, right? So if prison isn't the appropriate place for him, maybe an inpatient psychiatric facility is. One way or the other, it sounds like there were opportunities to get Brown off the streets, and those opportunities were not taken as recently as January of this year. And now Arina Zarutska is dead, allegedly, at Brown's hands. Today's armed citizen story from Arkansas, where a special prosecutor has found that a shooting in Lavaca, Arkansas, in the western part of the state, was in fact an act of self-defense. As was reported by Channel 4029 in Fort Smith, Fayetteville, A special prosecutor declined to file criminal charges back in this shooting that happened on July the 10th, ruling that the shooter acted in self-defense. Happened during a confrontation between two individuals who were described as former friends, both of them cabinet makers. Body camera video from Lavaca police shows officers arriving at a home after reports of a shooting where police found Brad Jones of Paris, Arkansas, with a gunshot wound to the stomach. Jones passed away at a local hospital. Kermit Acosta, who was doing cabinet work at the home when Jones arrived, he was detained at the scene and later interviewed by investigators. He says it wasn't supposed to happen on that body cam footage, saying that he retrieved a firearm after he felt threatened. Acosta said he wanted his $2,000. And I told him, I said, when you fix my cabinets, I told you I'd pay you. And when he said, we're going to whoop your ass, I took it as both of them, meaning Jones and apparently another individual there at the scene. Acosta said, I wasn't taking on two guys, so I reached in the truck and I grabbed a gun. The homeowner, I guess, who was having the cabinet work done, told police that man there, the one that got shot, had the other guy blocked in. He was screaming in his face, saying, I will come to every GD job you're at. A co-worker said that Jones told Acosta to put the gun down, moved closer to Acosta before the shot was fired. A friend who was with Jones offered a different account, saying that Acosta, quote, instantly got the gun as Jones approached, that the shooting happened as he was handed Jones's glasses. Lavaca police initially worked the case, but the police chief recused himself, citing a friendship with the victim. So the Sebastian County Sheriff's Office took over the investigation. A special prosecutor was appointed because the DA actually knows both of the individuals in question, I guess. And so another DA was appointed to review potential charges. 14th Judicial DA David Etheridge concluded that Acosta's use of force was justified under Arkansas law, which permits deadly force when a person reasonably believes it is necessary to protect against death or serious physical injury. So there you go. The family of Mr. Jones says they're not pleased with this decision, that they are evaluating other options moving forward, so perhaps they'll file a civil case, but no criminal charges after the DA ruled that Mr. Acosta was acting in self-defense. Finally, today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A 72-year-old surfer from Volusia County, Florida, who rescued a father and a son from a rip current. I mean, I was kind of heroic just being 72 years old and out on the waves. Personally, David Coffey, who goes by the name of Bean, was surfing in New Smyrna Beach, Florida. This was on Tuesday. It was just before noon. He heard cries for help. He said, I looked out in the water and I saw somebody floating backwards and I saw somebody else further in. The two individuals, a father and son, had been pulled into a rip current. The son's surfboard leash snapped, so he floated away from his board. Coffey paddled out to rescue the son, who was closer, and then went back for his father. He said he was underwater. I had to pull him up out of the water and put him up on my board. He said it was some of the toughest paddling that he has ever done, despite decades of surfing experience. He says, if I wasn't there, they would have been in the Bahamas or underwater. He said, I just happened to be there, and I'm glad that I was. More than 50 years ago, Coffey said he was a lifeguard there in Volusia County. He said his rescues were mostly minor. He said this was definitely a life-changing experience, just to be able to save two lives to where they might not ever have been found. Thank God I was there. Emergency responders showed up on the scene as Coffey was bringing the father back to shore. Both victims looked over. Looks like they're both going to be okay. And again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. 72-year-old Bean Coffey, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I will see you back here again tomorrow. Joe Laporto is going to be with us from the New Jersey Firearms Owner Syndicate. You know, they've been doing fantastic work getting communities across New Jersey to not repeal, but refund portions of the concealed carry application fee that's collected by municipalities. So I believe they've got about a half dozen communities in New Jersey that have agreed to return that money to applicants. But there was one community where this came up for a vote, and the all-Republican board rejected this proposal. This was Old Tappan, New Jersey. We're going to talk about that specifically with Joe, but we're also going to talk about those ongoing efforts to reduce the unreasonable fees that it takes to exercise a fundamental right in the Garden State. So I'm looking forward to talking with Joe. It's his first time on the program. It's going to be a great conversation. Hope you'll be able to be a part of it as well. And of course, be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. We've got a lot of litigation news this week. But we also do have some legislative news, because California's legislature, they're getting back at it. As you heard Rick Travis earlier this week, some 1,400 bills up for consideration in one day. And a couple of them are gun control bills, including AB 1127. That is the ban on the sale of Glock handguns. The Senate expected to take that up this week. So we've got to the latest for you there as well. Have a great rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.